Baby, could you just take a look at something?
What?
Just right here on my back.
This is a conversation that's been happening around the metro.
Does that look like a spider bite?
Hold on, let me see. No, it looks like a mosquito bite.
But it's been there for a long time, like a few days, and it's like red all around it.
Like, sometimes they get. Mosquito bites get red and big. Remember that one? Callie has one like that, kind
But not for so many days.
of. Not a spider bite. It doesn't have those two marks like a spider. I think it's just a mosquito bite.
So annoying.
The answer to these citywide back scratch dilemmas may be oak mites. I'm Gina Kaufman, and in case you haven't heard, the oak mite has been inflicting mysterious bug bites in Kansas and Missouri this year. We aren't typically oak mite territory, so people have been pretty weirded out by it. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to find out what the deal is with oak mites, and just a heads up, our nature exploration gets less itchy as the hour progresses. Stay tuned for a novelist's meditation on gardens later on. For now, oak mites. Dr. Pavika Sarapalli, you work in health services at KU. When did you start hearing about unusual bug bites?
Well, last year we had a really early peak with insect bites in late August, early September. And at first we didn't know what they were because they looked a little different. And then we got information through the public health in K-State that we were having an oak mite kind of bloom and epidemic. And then we kind of saw the pattern, and the first frost came, it died off. But sure enough, this fall they're back again, and this year we know what they are, so we're a little more prepared.
So let's back up. When you first started encountering these bites, what were you hearing and what did you think was going on?
Well, the students were saying that they were incredibly itchy, by far the itchiest bite they had ever gotten. And they do last a long time and get very red and very large. So a lot of people were coming in saying, I'm afraid I've gotten a spider bite.
Were you afraid of that when you heard and saw what people were dealing with?
Not really. They don't look like spider bites, and spider bites are typically painful, not itchy. But we definitely wanted to take them seriously, especially on a college campus. The buildings are old. We have spiders. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't brush people off. But they clearly look and behave differently, so we knew that that's not what was going on.
So were there any other false predictions, or you just were it was mysterious and then you figured it out?
Well, we thought about scabies. They don't look like scabie bites, but that's about how itchy they are, and people were just driving themselves crazy, scratching themselves in their sleep. So at first we thought, well, it doesn't look like scabies, but better safe than sorry. And I know I personally treated probably one or two people for scabies last year at first. They also look a lot like chigger bites, but they go in a different distribution. Chigger bites tend to be in your warm body spots, and these are always on the exposed areas of your body, so that was kind of confusing as well.
Warm body spots. I've never heard that phrase before.
I'm sorry, that's not a good way of putting it, but yeah, chiggers like to go in your socks and in your waistline, by your belt and in your underarms, and the oak mites always want to go in the neck and the shoulders and the upper body because they're exposed and they can just fall right on you and easily access that area. So we knew they look like chigger bites. They act like chigger bites, but they're not in the right spots.
Gotcha.
So that was another thought. Yeah.
So you started getting these calls, and then this fall after the first frost is when it's really started to pick up, you were saying?
No, I would say it seems that since the leaves started turning and falling off the trees, in early August when it was hotter, we didn't see as much of it. But after Labor Day, I think it's really picked up quite a bit.
What? So the leaves falling is the cause of that?
I don't know. I think that definitely plays a role. I think also just the school year started and our campus has a lot of oak trees and people are walking all over the place. So it may just simply be that people are going where the mites are, but I'm sure they're falling down with the leaves as well as just falling down all by themselves. So it's easy access for them.
Are people, I mean, you mentioned spiders, but I'm not in the habit of calling the doctor when I get a bug bite, and you work with college students who aren't known for being really proactive about visiting doctors. There must be something about this particular bite that's kind of freaking them out. Is it just the spider bite thing, or is it something else?
I think that they're worried, and they would rather just make sure, because everyone's worried about the spider bite that turns into a big open sore, which almost never happens. But honestly, I do think because there's a lot of old wives' tales about, oh, the dorms have spiders, or all old buildings have spiders. So I think college students are always kind of on the lookout for spiders when they move into their dorms. But I think it's the intense itch. I mean, they're very uncomfortable, and they're waiting for the bites to go away, and they're not going away. And I think it's just that it's driving them crazy, and they want it to stop.
Is this one of the itches that you are not supposed to scratch?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There aren't too many itches you should scratch, but I think with this one, that's a big part of why they don't go away so quickly, is even though people are keeping their hands off as much as they can, it's really hard not to scratch. And then in your sleep, I think people are scratching without realizing it.
This might be a little outside the territory of just the oak mite, but if we're not supposed to scratch, do you know why we itch? I mean, does itching serve any purpose?
That's like, why is the sky blue? That's a great question. I know that the body's allergic response involves histamine, and histamine causes your blood vessels to dilate to increase blood flow to the area. I think that's your body's way of trying to get rid of the offending substance and also maybe get rid of any potential infection that could be co-occurring. But unfortunately, histamine also produces itching as kind of a byproduct. So the itching itself really might not be part of the helpful response, but it certainly gets your attention, and you'll make an effort to avoid things that make you itch. So in the long run, it's probably productive.
So if people are not supposed to itch or scratch their itches, what do you advise them to do?
You have a few good options. I would definitely invest in hydrocortisone over-the-counter cream. And even though they say you can only use it once or twice a day, I always tell people, when your hand goes up to itch, put the cream on instead. And that way you'll be making that bite go away instead of enhancing its growth. Benadryl, if it's not too sedating, is wonderful. But if you can't tolerate the sedation of Benadryl, any of your over-the-counter antihistamines are useful and will definitely make the bite go away faster.
Are you surprised to see oak mites here this year? I guess we had them once before in 2004, but I don't remember it being such a big deal.
You know, from what I've read, it's just sort of unpredictable and relates to weather patterns and moisture. And I'm also not sure if you get a bumper crop of mites, if you're more likely to get another season that's bad in the future, because now you've got all these little reproductive kind of annoying pests. And the entomologist that you have coming on later can probably speak more to it. But
We will get him to elaborate for sure.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, kind of bugs beget bugs, I think.
Well, bugs beget bugs. You heard it here first. Thanks, Dr. Sarapalli.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Pavika Sarapalli joined us from Watkins Health Center at KU. Rick Miller is the gentleman she referred to just a moment ago. He's with us now from the K-State Extension in Johnson County, where he's an agriculture agent. And Rick, I hear that as part of your job, you are responsible for home pests. What is a home pest?
Yeah, so think about all those insects crawling around your home, whether that's ants or spiders or termites, cockroaches, oak leaf itch mites. Those are what we refer to as home pests then.
So that they live in your house?
Yeah, in or immediately around your house, and all those things that give us issues from time to time. Those are the things we get a lot of calls on. We have a lot of publications on, even do some classes on from time to time. And right now, all the calls have tended to be on this oak leaf itch mite.
Really? So you're getting tons of calls about it.
We are. So it's pretty easy to kind of take the temperature of the community and what's going on out there by the number of phone calls that we get, either coming in directly to someone like myself, or we have an extension Master Gardener hotline where people are used to asking questions about lawn and garden. So as they're outside doing those kind of chores, and then just like the students on campus at KU, all of a sudden seeing all these red, itchy bites on them, they want to know what it is, how to control them, and not have to deal with that anymore.
I fear that we might be driving people crazy talking about itching so much, but I was thinking before that a home pest would be like as opposed to a visiting pest. And if we imagine that I'm right, even though I'm not, is the oak mite a home pest in that sense, or is it just visiting?
I think it's just visiting. Like many pests, you know, it's kind of seasonal. It's really something that happens probably mid to late summer, and then here in the fall, we don't tend to see them the rest of the year. So kind of that occasional visiting one is great. And then even as you talked a little bit earlier with the doctor, every year is not as bad as perhaps the year before. You know, you indicated that this first kind of cropped up on our radar screen here in Kansas about a dozen years ago in 2004, but it's not been this bad every year. Some years it's just not high enough populations we even see that, or we get that many calls. But unfortunately, right now it's one of those high peak years and we're getting a lot of calls.
What do you think accounts for that? I mean, is it the reproductive cycle of the bug itself? Is it weather, environmental conditions?
Yes, you're an expert already. You hit it on the head. Really, those reasons. You know, there's so many environmental conditions that cause those populations to rise or ebb and flow. So the amount of moisture and temperature within a given year, the insect's individual life cycle, how fast they are able to reproduce. And on the oak leaf itch mites, that only happens in about a week. So in a very short period of time, they can rebreed and start those cycles all over again. And then a lot of it has to do with their food supply. You have to remember that oak leaf itch mites primarily are out there feeding on another insect on the oak tree.
What insect is that?
It's actually called a midge. And a midge in its adult
form. That's a real name of a bug.
It is. So a midge in an adult form is really a very small fly, almost a wasp type fly. And that earlier in the season, that fly will lay eggs on the leaves of oak trees. Those eggs will eventually hatch out into larvae. And as the larvae feed on that oak leaf a little bit, they secrete a substance that causes that oak leaf to deform or form a gall around that larva. So if you've ever looked at oak leaves and you've seen this kind of puffy gall around the margins or on the vein,
oh yeah,
that's this midge that's causing it to happen. Well, that larva that's rolled up inside the gall, almost like a hot dog on a bun or something, that mite, that oak leaf itch mite, is actually preying upon the larva, and that's their primary host. So if you've got a lot of galls, a lot of midges, then you got a banquet for all of those oak leaf mites.
Well, if they're eating that stuff, why do they care about us?
Because eventually they run out of their primary food source, and those populations have built up so fast to take care of that, they're looking for something else. Or as they get dislodged from that leaf, maybe that leaf falls to the ground here in the fall, or just the wind knocks them off, because you're talking about hundreds and thousands of those mites on the leaves and on the tree. They land on us. We're not their primary host, but they're still hungry, so they're looking for something to feed on, and so they're going to start biting us. And
what is it they get from us? I mean, they're not puncturing deep in like, I mean, what is it they get from just the surface of our skin?
Good question. So they're feeding on that larva, really sucking the juices out of it. I know, isn't that a great picture? Well, they're trying to do the same for us. They're not after a bloodbath like ticks or mosquitoes are, but they're really after the juices in our body. So as they bite, they're sampling us and seeing if that's good material to eat or not. And it may take several bites or even a day or two to figure out we're not their primary source. But in the meantime, we're getting the effect of all those bites. And next thing you know, you've got, you know, a dozen, 20, 50 bites on your body. And I think it's just the number of those bites and the severity of that itching which draws the great attention then.
How big is the oak mite itself?
You know, it's really, really small. I usually tell people they're pretty much microscopic. They're about 0.2 of a millimeter or 1/100th of an inch big. So really with the naked eye, we can't see them. You've got to be able to use a microscope. You might compare that with a chigger, which is also a mite. You could actually see that little bitty chigger crawling on your leg or arm if you were out in the tall grass. You probably will never see that oak leaf itch mite crawling around on you.
Well, what does it look like? I mean, I know it's microscopic. Have you gotten to see it under a microscope?
You know, I have. We've got a stereo microscope at the office that we use for identifying insects that people bring in. And last week, I went out and collected some oak leaves and looked at them underneath the scope. And I believe I found some. They are incredibly tiny. So even under the scope, they're pretty hard to see. They tend to be almost clear, tannish in color. All mites have 8 legs, so that's pretty obvious. You can see those 8 legs out there, but they're very slowly crawling around on that leaf. And if you'd rub it on your skin or just imagine those kind of floating through the air as you're outside doing chores and they're getting on your face and neck and arms and shoulders, that exposed skin.
This is horrible.
Yeah, they're sampling you then to see if you're anything good to eat. And I always tell people, you're not probably feeling the bite. They're so small, you're not feeling that bite. And the results of their bites don't usually show up for probably half a day, 10, 14 hours later. But you're outside all day long, you go to bed, you wake up the next morning, and you wonder where all these bites came from.
And is that why a lot of people think that it happened to them in bed?
Yes, exactly. Because if you are out working during the day or in the afternoon or you come home at night and work, those bites aren't going to show up, like I said, till 10 or 14 hours later. So you sleep on it, wake up, and you think, did I get bitten during the night? And of course, some people might think of bed bugs that has grown in severity. But you kind of have to trace back your activity. And that was when you were outside doing gardening or mowing the lawn or playing with the kids in the leaves.
This creature sounds really kind of awful. I mean, is there anything good about it? Does it like control some other pest population or provide a food source for something we're more fond of?
You know, that's a great question. My daughter is 15 years old, and we just had this conversation the other day about why we have some insects. And most insects have a purpose and they're good. They either break down organic matter or they feed on other insects, and so they're good. I'm not sure I found a great reason for the oak leaf itch mite yet. So maybe we could ask people to tell us a good reason for having those around.
Do you, I mean, as a guy who specializes in pests, I mean, that seems like my skin is crawling a little bit just from this one conversation, but you kind of talk about this kind of creature all day long. And I appreciate that you're being honest that you can't find the good in the oak mite, which you're also calling the itch mite.
Yep.
Do you find good in other pests, or do you just have a good attitude about these creatures that gets you through the day specializing in them?
Good question. I try to see the good in most things. So even in pests, I try to think the good. You know, take an example of a termite. We know how destructive they are in your house, and we hate to have those. But in nature, termites are great because they're breaking down all those trees that are dying in the woods and turning them into compost and eventually to soil. So they have a very positive purpose out in the environment. We just don't want them in our home or our apartment chewing on the wood that we live in our homes then. I just can't think of a really good reason why those oak leaf itch mites are out there. Maybe to sell Benadryl and calamine lotion and cortisone cream.
Aha, it's a conspiracy.
Absolutely.
What questions do you have about the oak mite? I mean, do you think there's some bigger story that this bug's appearance in our area might be telling us?
You know, one of the questions I certainly have, we talked about this coming on the scene in 2004, about a dozen years ago. The literature talks about it probably came from Europe. And so why did it mysteriously show up here in the Midwest back in the early 2000s? You know, did that come with some grass seed or something else that caused that to pop up? And now that it's here, it's just going to keep getting worse and worse. I don't know. That's a good question.
Agriculture agent Rick Miller from the K-State Extension, thanks so much.
Awesome. It's been fun being here. Thanks a lot, Gina.
When KCOR Central Standard returns, a little relief: why a novelist is meditating on gardens, a new project from Thomas Fox Averill. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're spending the rest of this morning's show with novelist Thomas Fox Averill. His newest project is a website that houses his writing on gardens. He hasn't just been traipsing around his own backyard either. He's traveled extensively to produce this body of work, and the kinds of things he explores in the garden might surprise you. Immigration issues, for example. Thomas Fox Averill, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Explain your garden plots project.
Well, I've always been interested in gardening and have done it since the time I was 10 years old and read the Little House on the Prairie books and Farmer Boy. And I said to my mom, I want to grow some corn. And she said, oh, sure. And so she made a big deal out of that. And I've gardened ever since in my life. And I've written about gardens before, but I thought, Washburn University, where I teach, has a wonderful summer sabbatical program. And I thought, if I had a month and could travel abroad, I would most like to visit botanical gardens.
And why botanical gardens? I mean, you're talking about at 10 years old, you wanted to grow corn. And yeah. Botanical gardens, you know, they're not known for their corn output, their corn
no.
yield.
Many of them have little vegetable components in there, sort of tip of the hat to gardening as a way of surviving. But I think I was interested in the way in which on a large scale. For example, you take a place like the Chelsea Physic Garden in London, the very first botanical garden in England. And really, it's the home of everything that can cure you or kill you. And it was a pharmacy, really. And so that whole history of botanical gardens really arose, first of all, as pharmacies.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Chelsea Physic Garden, it's called that because it has to do with physician, being a physician. And it was associated with the Royal Hospital in England. And for years, you couldn't even go into it unless you were part of that elite group.
So I totally understand wanting to visit gardens for a month. Where does the writing come in? I mean, this is not the most self-evident project for a writing professor.
Well, I've always been so interested in gardens and gardening, and I'd written some stories and even had some components in my novels in which someone was gardening. And I thought, you know, I'd like to do a whole collection of stories about gardens and gardening and plants and garden design. And this will be my inspiration. So if I visit 21 gardens in 31 days, I'll get an idea. Every day I'll write down an idea for a story. And then I got some great ideas, but I was also working on a novel at the time. And so I said, I better sketch these out a little bit. So when I sketched them out, they were sometimes just a paragraph long, and they were tiny, but they seemed complete to me, and so I started calling them garden plots, little plots.
Yeah, they are, and it's hard for me to describe what the form is. I mean, I guess they're kind of sketches in a way, but they do feel like you've created maybe your own genre in a way, because they're prose. I mean, they're in paragraph form, but they're pretty abstract, a lot of them.
Yes, I sort of gave myself free rein. I mean, I'm a short story writer and a novelist, but I wrote things that I called rants. I wrote parables. I wrote what I call meditations, philosophical pieces. There are some that are like when I was visiting the Chelsea Physic Garden in London, I had that experience, sort of the question you're asking. I had that experience. A docent was in a greenhouse. It was raining. she and I were in there together, and she said, well, where are you from? And I told her Topeka, Kansas, and I was on sabbatical from my university. And she said, oh, you're a biologist or a botanist. I said, no, I'm a creative writer. And she said, sort of, you know, in a very British way, she said, well, nothing literary ever happened here. And then hour later, she came and found me, and she said, I was wrong. Wilfred Owen, the great World War I poet, spent his last night in England in the Chelsea Physic Garden and then went to France and never came back. So I wrote a letter to Wilfred Owen, another form called Letter to Wilfred Owen, and basically it says, you know, it's, Dear Wilfred Owen, you know, how did you spend your last night here before they shipped you to a war where they were digging trenches for men instead of furrows for seed? And just a series of questions that I might ask him if I were interviewing him. So, I wrote letters, all kinds of, and prose poems and some short stories, but I gave myself free rein.
The comment that nothing literary ever happened here, it does sort of assume that writers are looking for something literary when writers are actually usually looking to immerse themselves in some kind of life experience that is going to be transformed into material. And I've known a lot of writers who do also like to garden or spend time in gardens, and I wonder what you think that might be about. I mean, maybe we'll come back to that one because it's kind of a big question, but let's, for example, your rants. I mean, you tap into either disappointments or frustrations or just sort of cultural critiques through these garden visits. One of the rants is in Philadelphia. It's you're visiting the garden of one of your gardening heroes. First of all, who was he?
Well, John Bartram was really the first botanist in the Americas, even before the United States. In fact, he and his cohorts, and I read about them in a wonderful book called The Brother Gardeners. And that book is about the huge plant exchange that was going on between England and the United States. Wasn't even the United States then. In fact, they were all really angry about the Revolutionary War because it interrupted their productive trading of seeds and plants and trees and saplings and all. So John Bartram is the first person to produce a botanical catalog. He discovered plants all around Pennsylvania and even as far as Florida. So he's one of our first genuine botanists, and he lived on the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia. And his garden is still preserved there. But when you read about something and you create a hero out of someone, and then you visit the actual place and see that it's a human place, people have tried hard to preserve it, but it's not this pristine shrine that you want it to be. So then you sort of start ranting about it. Where's the respect?
Yeah, I mean, especially after you've made a pilgrimage to a place that you've built in your imagination.
Exactly. And so many gardens and botanical gardens are sort of pilgrimages for people, especially in England. I ran across that sort of disappointment different times. We went to a garden, a walled garden in Scampston Garden, I think it was called, and some Dutch landscape architect had won the right to recreate this old castle garden inside these four walls. And the British tourists, oh, well, he's Dutch. He planted a whole section in grasses in a garden, you know. And so they were disappointed in that. So I wrote a little
piece. Because they're not flowers and they don't have the sort of the show.
Yeah, so I came home and wrote a piece called The Grass Garden about this guy who gets so excited about maybe creating a whole garden of grasses in central Kansas where they would do really well. And the board of directors who has this cache of money to spend on a great big botanical garden says, no grasses. And so at the end of the story, it's only the oak grass in the ditches that wave to the passersby to remind them that this place is really Kansas, not a rose garden.
And that's interesting because Kansas, I mean, you travel very far to see gardens, but of course there, you also visit ones nearby, but there are plenty of gardens nearby. Do you see something distinctive in the difference between the garden close to home and the garden that is more of the pilgrimage? Is the difference in you or in the garden?
I think the difference is probably in me rather than the garden, because, I mean, a botanical garden has a certain pretentiousness about it. Just, you know, I mean, I don't know. I shouldn't call it pretentious. I mean, like, if you visit a place like Palo,
I don't think it'll be offended.
No, but yeah, the garden won't. But the people, you know, I love Palo Garden, for example, and have traveled there a couple of times, and was inspired to write stories based on that. Spent a lovely morning and lunch with a guy named Matt Bunch, who grew up in Lawrence, and I know his dad, and he's a horticulturalist there, and it's a beautiful place, but a botanical garden has certain responsibilities to create sections and to create to bring along certain kinds of exotic plants, oftentimes, and I always find that sort of amusing. I wrote a little definition of gardens, and one of my definitions is it's a place where exotic plants are cultivated in a non-indigenous environment, and success is measured by their survival, rendering a satisfaction not unlike what one would feel shepherding a poodle across the Sahara. So there's a sort of naturalness and unnaturalness to botanical gardens that interests me.
But then on the flip side, there is a little bit of a critique in that, an observation you made about the language we use to describe weeds mirroring in many ways language that we use to talk about immigration.
Yes. Yes, I read a perfectly wonderful book that's just called Weeds, a sort of a history of the most hated plants in the world. And the author of it starts out his book saying that the 20th century, with its global trade, world wars, ubiquitous paranoia, brought with it not just new weeds, but new conceptions of what weeds might be and do. And he writes about weeds in very much the same way as some anti-immigrant politicians might talk about immigrants. They're invasive, they're opportunistic, they take over places where nobody else wants to live, they crowd out the good plants that have been there. It's a really an interesting metaphor, and I think that's when you were talking earlier about what writers are looking for. For me, a lot of it's like I'm looking for the metaphor. I'm looking for how this, because gardens and food and plants are so much a part of the cultural experience. You know, what do they tell us about immigration or about race or about gender roles, and you know, all of these things do come into play in a garden, just like they might in food criticism or any other intersection of people and culture.
Not to get too out there, but in Candide by Voltaire, mm-hmm. The author sort of encapsulates his version of the meaning of life with the phrase, "You must cultivate your garden." In other words, you have to create something and take care of it. And in doing that, you'll discover your meaning. Do you think that you're on sort of a Candide-like journey here, looking for the meaning of life in a garden?
If you hadn't brought up Voltaire, I would have, yes. Because I do think that, as someone who's always gardened, I've always found meaning in gardening. And it's the same way with writing. I think you kind of tease things along, and you kind of try to figure out what they mean and how they're going to grow, and how you can help them grow. And it's you know, your literary work and your plants are you're not in total control of them. It's not as easy as the fantastic song of plant a carrot, get a carrot, not a Brussels sprout. You know, that complaint about children, you never know. That's why I love vegetables. You know what they're about. You don't know what people are about. Well, frankly, you don't know what vegetables are about either. You don't know what anything's about. So gardening gives you a way to think about that.
Thomas Fox Averill, stay with me through the break, okay? We'll get back to his meditations on gardens when we return, and yours if you've had a major epiphany about life in the garden. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a sec. Thomas Fox Averill, good morning again.
Good morning to you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and Thomas and I are talking about his new project, a website called Garden Plots, mini stories, meditations, and rants inspired by visits to gardens in Europe, across the country, and also closer to home. I want to talk about some of the ones closer to home, just because so many of our listeners will have been to these places and can really imagine what it is that you experienced and discovered there. Let's talk about Luce Park, the Rose Garden.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, it's one of my favorite places. And they always say that rose by any other name would smell as sweet. But one of the wonderful things I love about roses is just their names. You know, that you go there and you can get a little pamphlet, a little brochure that tells you some of the names. Things like Knockout and Marilyn Monroe and Moondance and Whisper and Blue Yonder Quietness. And I sort of tried to put together a little poem, you know, that strings along all of these beautiful rose names. They're almost as beautiful as the roses themselves. And there's a wonderful rose garden in Topeka, too, the Rhenish Rose Garden. And so even though I might make fun of roses and how much care they need and whether they're indigenous and they're
kind of high maintenance.
Yeah. And they don't have what I call indigenuity. they have to be helped. Whereas wildflowers sort of have this indigenous ingenuity, which I call indigenuity,
gotcha.
You know, coming together. But the rose gardens are wonderful. And I visited Wichita, the Botanica Garden there. That's really nice. If anybody's been to Wichita to visit,
but wait, can I back
place.
Up to the Rose
sure,
Garden?
Sure.
What
yeah.
did from a literary standpoint? What did the Rose Garden at Luce Park inspire in you?
Well, to me, it inspired a way of talking about. I mean, one of the things that if you write about food or you write about the American West, as I have, or you write about things Scottish, you find this different vocabulary each place. And one of the things I liked about working in the garden is that the whole vocabulary of gardening, of shears and of pruning and of mulching and of, you know, there's suddenly all this new vocabulary that you sort of have to understand as technically what it is, but also as, like I said before, kind of as metaphor.
You know? You went to the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art, which is not a garden, but you treated it as one, which I find interesting.
Well, I did that because I was looking at the work of Dan Christensen, who's an abstract artist, and I thought it would make an interesting story. He literally just put down tubes and tubes of paint on the surface of his canvas, and then he actually took like a garden rake and then raked out his abstract shapes and forms, and then the colors just sort of erupt out of the canvas in the same way that when you turn over soil. It reminded me of that so much. So I wrote a story about a farmer who retires and he takes up painting, and he realizes that not everything is just green and brown, like a green John Deere tractor on a brown field. There's all these colors in nature, even in the soil when you turn it over. So he starts doing the same thing with paint, and everybody says to him, "What are those?" And he says, "Paintings." And they say, "But of what?" And then at the end he says, "How do I know? I'm just a farmer."
You seem really interested in the process and kind of in the process of gardening, and both when you were talking about the shearing and pruning, that's a language, but it's also a language for how we transform something and how we shape it. I mean, there's a lot of shaping and manicuring in botanical gardens and in these really formal gardens.
Yeah, there is. And one of the most extreme cases of that is what they call espalier, where on a walled garden you might grow a crabapple tree, say, and then you cut the branches so that they literally are crucified against the wall. So it's a really interesting look at very, very shaped fruit trees in botanical gardens, especially in England. So I wrote a story about a guy who's lining up his family to take their picture against this espaliered wall. He's being very controlling, and he's doing to the family what the gardeners have done to the tree that's behind the family. And you realize how much people want to control nature. I mean,
whether it's other human beings or plants.
Yeah, both at the same time if they can. So it's, and gardening is a lot about control and about weeding. My story from Powell Garden is just about a guy who volunteers there and goes in and weeds.
A real guy or a fictional guy?
A fictional guy. But I saw some volunteers there, and I got to thinking about how those people don't really shape the garden, but they shape what you see by shaping what you don't see. If you don't see a weed, then you do see the rose that's behind the weed. If there was a weed there, then you would see the weed, and it would detract from the beauty of the rose. I had that same feeling visiting Longwood Garden in Pennsylvania, which is on, you know, the estates. A lot of these gardens are on estates of very wealthy people. So one of my critiques is a little bit like, here's what you don't think about when you admire the garden. You look at the red rose, but you don't think about the tubercular blood that's coughed on the pillow of the worker who made the money for the person whose estate you're standing on. And you have to think about all of that at the same time.
Does that spoil it in any way for you? I mean, that meditation got very humane, but also very dark.
Yeah, that was a dark one. And in my botanical garden that I created, because on the website, each one of these is in a different section, I have some little benches, and they're called reality checks. And that was just a reality check. It's sort of like, you know, let's think of the cost. Every beauty has a cost. It costs money to have beauty, whether it's in a restaurant with food or whether it's in a botanical garden with roses.
So, even with the wildflowers you were talking about?
Yeah, that came out of also, I ran into a garden in Oak Park, Illinois, and the sign says, "This garden planted in wildflowers." And I thought, is that an oxymoron? You know, if it's a wildflower, why are you planting it? It's supposed to just be wild. So, yeah, we do have all of these gradations of planting, weeding, pruning, what's wild. A garden is certainly the opposite of wilderness.
One of your previous conversations on KCUR, you were talking to Angela Elam about your background. Your youth spent working in a cemetery.
Yeah.
And how that had been inspiring to you. And I was thinking about that you have found inspiration in these two places where the phrase, the word plots.
Yeah.
You know? And when you think about a cemetery and a garden, there is something both equal and opposite about those two spaces. I wonder if that's something that resonates with you.
That's a very interesting observation, because you care for a cemetery in the same way that you care for a garden. And in order for everything to look right, the things that aren't supposed to be there, the weeds around the headstones and all of that, you know, have to be kept just right for the full effect of, say, a tombstone instead of a rose bush, maybe. But you are working to create a place of peace, a place of meditation, a place of beauty, and without distraction. And people who visit a cemetery want that in the same way that they do in a botanical garden.
Does this project that you've done, which is a writing and traveling project, really, has it changed you as a gardener?
Oh, not too much. I still mostly just grow vegetables and let wildness in where I can. And, you know, I'm not a very strict gardener with my garden.
What do you mean by strict?
Well, I have, if a volunteer tomato comes up, I'll let it come up. I have fennel plants that have reseeded themselves all over the garden. I have dill plants. I have cilantro that comes up, you know. I have winter onions that keep spreading. And I'm just sort of a welcoming person, you know. And if a rabbit comes and eats a tomato, it makes me a little mad, but it's like, okay. And the rabbits are very sophisticated now. They stand on their hind legs and eat the beautiful tomatoes that my wife Jeffrey Ann Gowdy and I are just getting ready to, you know, to pluck right before we can get to them. So next year they'll have bibs. I mean, they're really getting sophisticated in how they eat tomatoes. These are rabbits, not just squirrels now. So I don't know.
Is this a way partly of inviting characters into your life? I mean, the rabbit has clearly become a character who is, even if it just makes you a little mad, at odds with you.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Each plant you grow, you know, well, that one's doing well, and that one's not doing well. You know, you sort of look, next year we'll buy a different kind of pepper or a different kind of tomato plant. So yeah, then it, like my wife and I don't have pets, but we spend a lot of time caring for things in the same way that people might take care of their pets. And just like having a pet is good for you, I think having a garden is good for you.
I want to talk to you about, you quickly, you visited vegetable gardens too. I mean, you didn't only visit the botanical gardens. Did your observations have kind of a different character in those gardens, or do you see a through line?
Well, I think they have a slightly different. One of the most interesting places to visit vegetable gardens is like at Monticello and at Mount Vernon, because those places were places where indeed people lived off of the vegetables that were grown in the local garden. So you look at a place like Monticello, they even sell you seeds out of that garden that you can take home and plant in your own garden. So you have a little bit of Monticello and Thomas Jefferson in your own yard. Both those gardens were interesting to me because they also were cultivated by slaves. And they were huge gardens, and that kind of agricultural output not only fed Thomas Jefferson and his family, but oftentimes fed slaves as well. And slaves were sometimes given small plots of ground that they could work on their very own, and whatever they were able to grow, they could eat. So you get that intersection again, not just beauty, but also sustenance.
This historic research is... I just want to touch quickly before you go on your upcoming project, which will, I'm assuming, involve a lot of historical research, a novel with a protagonist who is a 19th century Kansas woman.
Yes, a very unconventional woman who becomes interested in fossils and in what she sees in the rocks around her. And this is shortly after Quantrill's raid in 1863, which is shortly after Origin of Species, and in which Darwin is calling upon people to fill the record. There are gaps here. We need to understand this. So amateur science became really important in the 19th century, especially. Lots of people had collections. So I'm writing about a woman who becomes obsessed with a particular kind of fossil and to adding to the fossil record just right here in Kansas. And there are many people like her, and there have been many people like that in the botanical world as well.
Do you have a favorite example of an amateur scientist you've learned about?
Well, I have probably my most favorite is Tracy Chevalier wrote a book called Remarkable Creatures, which is about Mary Anning and Elizabeth Philpott, two actual women off the coast of England, on the coast of England, who Mary Anning was really the one who started finding the big dinosaurs in England. And there's a museum dedicated to her, and her stuff is in the British Museum. And yeah, she was a great model for for all of this.
Our time is up. Thomas Fox Averill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. We'll link from that page to the website for Thomas's Garden Plots project so you can explore those writings on your own if you'd like. That's also where you can access yesterday's great conversation about the role of libraries in a free society. Tomorrow, we're back with a conversation about community policing. Don't miss that. Join the conversation. We'll be looking forward to involving you in it. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. We have help from intern Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman, and it's time to scoot on out of here. But Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.